Okay, so what about our civilization, our modern civilization? Is it doomed because of climate change, overpopulation, and some other things beyond our control? In a moment, anthropologists and novelists Michael and Kathleen Geer on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, two guests for you tonight. Michael Geer received his master's degree in anthropology from Colorado State University, and he went on to work as an archaeologist for Western Wyoming College in 1978. He has worked as a professional archaeologist for 29-plus years and started writing full-time in 1985. Kathleen Geer received her master's degree, summa cum laude, from California State University and studied biblical history and archaeology at the Hebrew University of Jerusalem, Israel. She was working on her PhD in American Indian History at UCLA when she came to Wyoming in 1980 to serve as the Wyoming State Historian and later Archaeologist for the United States Department of the Interior. Michael and Kathleen have more than 200 nonfiction publications in the fields of archaeology, history, publishing, and bison management, and have authored or co-authored 39 novels in five genres: historical fiction, Western mystery, science fiction, and the modern thriller genre. In addition to writing books and running their own archaeological research firm, they own and operate Red Canyon Buffalo Ranch near Thermopolis, Wyoming. In 2004, Red Canyon Ranch received the National Producer of the Year Award from the National Bison Association. They are our guests tonight of Coast to Coast. Michael and Kathleen, hello, you two. How are you?
Hi, George. We're doing well tonight.
Great. You know, I must confess, I have never eaten bison, but everyone tells me it is the best hamburger you can have.
Do you know, it is, and it's really good for you, too, George. It's high in omega-3 fatty acids, has twice the iron that beef does. It's low in cholesterol and fat, so it's a healthy meat also.
And we don't put any growth hormones or steroids or anything like that in the animals.
Michael, okay, what does it taste like, though? I mean, if you had to compare it to anything.
Well, a lot of people can't tell the difference between buffalo meat and beef.
Okay. Okay, and I'm sure the Native Americans, when they captured buffalo for food, harvested it for food, they got their meat that way.
They sure did, yeah. And one of the great things about it is that it's just so much more healthy for you.
Well, of course, we're not here just to talk about buffalo. There's bigger earth changes ahead for all of us.
Yeah, we're doomed.
Tell us a little bit about both of you and your work beyond the bio, if you two would.
Oh, Mike and I still run our own archaeological research company, George, so we're out every summer for the most part doing archaeological surveys and archaeological excavations. We find a lot of interesting things, which we then put into our novels that we write about North American prehistory. Not only that, but we generally raise a couple of buffalo bottle babies. Boy, try saying that fast three times.
Mm-hmm. Especially at this time of night.
It took me 8 years to get used to that.
I'll bet. Yeah, and the other thing that we do is try and educate Americans about the length, breadth, and depth of our national prehistory. Because, George, we live on a continent with lost archaeology. We've got 15,000 years of people developing cultures, building civilizations that in turn have risen and fallen. And a lot of what we try to do in the books, we write them as novels because you can make the people, the land, the culture, and generally the catastrophe that they survived, come alive in a way that you just can't do with nonfiction.
Absolutely. Like your latest work, People of the Nightland, where you illustrate that. Is there, because we're going to talk a lot about this, and, you know, I want to give people hope, but I also want to give people a very realistic look at what they think they can anticipate in the next few years and in the future down the line. You know, I've got three grandchildren, Michael and Kathleen, and you know what? I care about their future, and I want to make sure that they've got a planet, they've got an environment to live in. But it bothers me because I'm really not sure deep down inside what they're going to have, and I'm sure you two feel the same way.
Yeah, it worries us very much, George, because over and over throughout prehistory, We see just about the same pattern that happens to human civilizations. You know, you end up going through a period where the climate is lovely, it's warm, it's wet, and people can produce a lot of food. And inevitably, when you have a lot of food, your population explodes. And then, you know, you've got a lot of mouths to feed, and suddenly the climate changes. And when the climate changes, then you have a shorter growing season, you can't produce as much food. And inevitably what happens is warfare breaks out because, George, when you can't feed your children or your grandchildren, you will do anything to find food for them. And if that means taking it from your neighbors down the road, then that's what you're going to do. And as soon as warfare breaks out, then societies collapse, civilizations simply go away. And societies devolve.
Things get nasty.
Yeah, brutal and nasty.
Well, and even the quest for water, I think, will be a major source for war.
It will, absolutely.
Let's talk a little. Go ahead.
Has been in the past, too, George. This isn't the first time that we're gonna human civilizations are gonna have to worry about finding water for their people.
Well, you know, I just look at the incredible type of development in Las Vegas whenever I go out there. And it's huge. I mean, in over the last 15 years, I remember there was like a nine-year span before I was there. I was there once, and then 9 years later, popped in again. I couldn't believe it. What do those people do if something happens to the water source? And I believe they get it from the Colorado River.
Right. What's going to happen there is the same thing that happened to a people that we called the Hohokam. And these are folks, they were farmers that lived in the Phoenix, Gila and Salt River basins in central Arizona. And you've been to Phoenix, right?
Yes, I have.
Okay. Big time desert. And what the Hohokam did were they developed a series of canals, a lot like the modern Salt River Project, that allowed them to flourish. And when we see collapses further north of people that we call the Anasazi, a lot of those refugees went down, went to work for the Hohokam, and then promptly in 1389, they had a huge, gigantic storm up in the Mogollon Mountains. The flood washed down and took out their entire irrigation system, and the civilization collapsed overnight.
That was it. They were done.
That was it. They were done. And, again, things got nasty. So what we have to look at today is, I don't know if you've read the book Cadillac Desert or not.
No,
but
I have not.
It talks specifically about what's going to happen if the Colorado River shuts off. And some of the latest environmental predictions that we have say that the American West is headed into an extended drought. So, don't know.
What do you two think happened to the Mayan civilization?
They went through a period of drought, George, and warfare broke out. And as soon as warfare breaks out, you know, society, things get really nasty. But we know that they went through a drought. And immediately, people start cutting down all of the trees so that they can plant the fields and crops to try to feed their people. And as soon as you cut down all of the trees, you destabilize the soils. When you go into a drought period, you end up with kind of dust bowl situations.
Don't you also kick up, Kathleen, viruses that have laid dormant for years?
Absolutely you do, George. And one of the things that we see, especially in North America, is outbreaks of things like tuberculosis that become rampant. We see this in the southwestern United States at about 1100 AD. Tuberculosis is rampant during this time period. And this is the same time period where you're watching, you know, like the Chichen Itza fall in Mesoamerica and the Chaco civilization in the southwest of North America falls, Tula in Mesoamerica falls, and
Cahokia.
Oh, yeah, not
too far. The central Mississippi Valley.
I've been there, and it's not too far from St. Louis where I am right now. That was at one point a huge populated area.
Oh, yeah. I mean, George, keep in mind, there were 250,000 people in the American bottoms around where modern St. Louis is today. And
jeez.
At Cahokia, they built the largest earthen structure in the world prior to mechanization. Huge civilization. And Cahokia is to the eastern United States as Rome was to the Mediterranean.
And they're gone.
It controlled everything.
And they're gone.
Yeah.
Now, do they die? Do they leave? What happens to them?
They do a little bit of both. A lot of warfare breaks out. Okay, let's to give your readers some perspective.
And my listeners.
Yeah.
And they're your readers. They're my listeners.
Yeah, well, that's what you get for having a couple of clapped out, exhausted, fatigued authors at the end of book tour on your radio show. We get a little daffy.
And you've got 3 hours to go, you know.
Oh, boy. That's all right. I got my can of Red Bull here. Breakfast of Champions.
Right. That'll push. You need 5-Hour Energy, one of our sponsors, but that's a different thing. Go ahead.
All right. Okay. But for your listeners, to put this into perspective, Cahokia really begins to establish itself at about 800 A.D., in the area right there around St. Louis. And it's a perfect place because all of the major rivers that control trade across the continent pretty much come together there. You've got the Illinois going up to the Great Lakes, the Missouri headed up into the North Plains. Just a little ways to the south, you have the Ohio River coming in with the Tennessee just upstream from that, and then the lower Mississippi Valley, all tied together right there at Cahokia. And they build a huge, gigantic network of urban areas. The biggest, of course, is around Monk's Mound at the Cahokia site just outside of Collinsville. But the what we see reflected in the archaeological record is that about 800 A.D., the corn cobs that they're raising are about the length of your hand, okay?
All right.
And by the time you get to 1150, they have exhausted the soils, and the corn cobs are the size of your index finger.
Ah, okay.
Okay, so that gives you an idea about the decrease in production. And then right at 1150 A.D., we have a climatic change. We go from the Neo-Atlantic period to what's called the Pacific Climatic Episode. And it gets cool and dry. And so the whole thing just falls apart.
All right, let's look at this population of the planet right now. We're at about 6.5 billion people.
That's right.
We project by when that we're going to go to 9 billion. When is that?
About by 2050, it'll be 9 to 12 billion.
Okay. The globalists, we are told, want to reduce the population of this planet down to 500 million. 500 million from the 6 to 9 billion that we have and will anticipate. Not a lot of people, 500 million people. How we're going to get there, that's another story as well. I don't know if you two have ever dived into that, the theory of globalists and what they'd like to do, but I guess to be very, very cruel about this, are the globalists, assuming that's what they want to do, regardless of their method, are they correct in wanting a reduced planet?
Always, George, no matter what the civilization is, no matter what the time period, overpopulation is the problem. That is the final straw that breaks the camel's back. And, I mean, they are right that population needs to be reduced. But, George, the question is, how do you do that? I mean, if you decide that, you know, certainly we're not just going to go out and murder all these people, right?
Well, so they may want to do that, but let's get to that a little later.
Oh, my gosh.
That's okay. We live in Wyoming. We're armed and dangerous.
that is a good question, Kathleen. How do you do it? Over what period of time
right.
do you do this? And how do you know at what point the planet has too many people to sustain?
I mean, one could say we're there now. Don't worry about this. The planet is going to take care of itself. Because we have reached the point with 6.5 billion people where we are doing just-in-time inventory for the entire world. And what we see reflected in the archaeological record is any time that you have a civilization or a society that doesn't have flexibility in the system to absorb hits, whether they're ecological or environmental or economic, the thing's going to break. And, gosh, when I was in graduate school in the 70s, we had really good data, rock-solid data, that we were going to run out of food by the mid-1990s. And, of course, modern agriculture has managed to let us extend that, but we've pushed it too far. It's going to break.
They say we're going to run out of seafood by 2040.
Right, yeah.
I believe in the Gaia theory. I believe this planet is alive. It's an organism just like a plant is, just like we are. Does it fight back by trying to, one, heal itself? Does it fight back to, if it feels as if the population is too big for it to sustain? Does it create these tsunamis and volcanoes and earthquakes and things that wipe out and obliterate people?
Well, yeah, it does, George, as a matter of fact. And we can talk about not just people, but it wipes out everything. In the last 500 million years, we have seen 5 mass extinctions on the Earth. And what we think happens during these times, you know, everybody talks about the KT boundary 65 million years ago when the dinosaurs went extinct. But there were far more dramatic extinctions in the history of the Earth. And one of them was right at the end of the Permian, about 250 million years ago. It's called the Great Dying because 90% of the ocean life ceased to exist and 70% of life on land ceased to exist. And essentially what happened is atmospheric carbon dioxide reached, I think it was about 3,000 parts per million. Keep in mind, right now we're at about 385, so we've got a long way to go.
Well, what we must have had cars and SUVs then, right?
Millions Not of that years I'm aware ago. Of.
Well, maybe we had advanced civilizations. Who knows?
But essentially what happened is the ocean became poisonous and started belching hydrogen sulfide gas into the oxygen, into the atmosphere.
Mm-hmm.
And basically poisoned the Earth, which is what killed off the life in the ocean as well as on land. So Mother Earth does protect herself. I certainly hope that human beings never live to see that. But eventually it probably will happen again. And disease is the other way, George, that Mother Earth protects herself.
Well, you asked the question, Kathleen, about these globalists, that if they indeed intend to do this, how would they do it? I think it's going to be with some kind of disease. I think it's going to be with some kind of a virus concoction that they've created, and they will just let it loose on the planet. Of course, they'll be well protected.
These people are insane.
Yes, they are. Yes, they are. There's no doubt about that. But so we agree that overpopulation is a huge problem. Are we at that point now?
Yes.
Yeah, we probably are, George, quite honestly.
Yeah. In fact, my suspicion is that we're probably about two billion over sustainability.
I was going to say, what do you think the comfortable level should be? And so you're saying around 4 billion, huh?
Yeah. Yeah, and again, that's looking at sustainability. Because
now, is that in a region, or that's is that planet-wide? All right, so like a 300 million United States, we should get that down to 200 million, I guess, right?
Yeah, maybe even 160.
Yeah, you know, Georgie, here's the problem. As the population increases, in order to feed the mouths out there, you have to cut down more trees to plant the fields and crops so you can feed people.
I wonder if we can get zero growth. Stay with us, Kathleen and Michael. We're going to take this quick break, and
sure,
we'll come right back and talk about how do you control this population. Can you have negative growth? We'll see. And our two special guests tonight, Michael and Kathleen Gear, their website, gear-gear.com. It's linked up at coasttocoastam.com right now. We'll be back with them in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, Michael and Kathleen, how do you justify your conclusion that we've got 2 billion way too many people on this planet?
Okay, the way that we do that is kind of the same way that we do raising buffalo, and that is that you've got a certain carrying capacity that the land has. And again, this is kind of a wild-ass guess on our part, but given the amount of deforestation that's gone on in the last 200, 300 years, There's a lot of that land that could be put back into forests. And keep in mind that when you're talking about things like atmospheric carbon dioxide, if you have 40 acres of forest land, it's going to process a whole lot more than 40 acres of soybeans. And now, George, when you fly over the United States, you know, from the time that you leave western Kansas, when you look down from an airplane, what do you see?
Well, you see plains, you see fields, you see crops.
Yeah.
Then you get into the mountains.
That's right. What you see, there is virtually not even hardly a single square inch of the eastern United States when you look down out of that airplane that it hasn't been modified by human beings. Yeah. Europe is the same way. And yeah, it's just a matter of if we're going to keep growing the population, we're going to have to cut down even more forests like we're doing in the Amazon and put it into agricultural fields. And yeah, we've got some real good information that shows that we are about 5,000 years overdue for an ice age.
Funny you say that, because my guest last hour said it's just starting.
Do you know, and he could, your guest last hour could be right. And here's why, George. About, you know, we go through these periods. Did he talk about the wobble of the Earth's axis?
Not a lot. We had a question about a polar shift, but he believes that the warming of the oceans are what will cause this coming ice age.
Well, he's right. He's right. It is one of the major things. And we have seen this, you know, over and over throughout the Earth's history. But right now, we are in the Earth's axis wobbles, okay? So in the summertime, when the Earth's axis wobbles and turns the northern hemisphere towards the sun, the Earth gets more solar radiation, right? Everything warms up. It's lovely. Right now, we're in glacial mode so far as the wobble of the axis is concerned. We should be in an ice age right now. And the reason we're not is probably because of agriculture. You know, Mike's talking about how we're going to have to cut down more forests to plant the fields and crops to feed people. And we've been doing this for 11,000 years, George. So we have effectively, because of agriculture and now also, you know, fossil fuel emissions, we have staved off an ice age. And if we can, if we're not very careful, we're going to tip that balance where the Earth warms up just enough to melt the ice sheets, for example, in Antarctica. And all we have to do is have the western ice sheets in Antarctica collapse, and it'll raise the ocean levels by 16 feet. I mean, 30% of Florida will vanish in a heartbeat. So he could very well be right. If that happens, the Earth could be knocked back into an ice age within 10 years, which is exactly what happened 13,000 years ago in a period that we call the Younger Dryas Ice Age.
Well, then there's your reduction of a population by more than 2 billion.
Absolutely.
Oh, yeah.
You're right.
If we don't have enough capabilities to take care of the people on this planet, then with our 6.5 billion, there are some regions where people are eating well. There are other regions where they aren't. They're starving to death. Why the inconsistencies? Can the planet today create enough food sources to take care of the population?
Yeah, it can today. But like you mentioned earlier, there are parts of the oceans, like the west coast of Africa, which are being fished at four times sustainability. And if you look at that as extractive food production, eventually what you end up doing is wiping out the ability for the ocean to feed you.
And then you have a severe problem.
Right.
Then you have famine. And once you have famine start, deprivation kicks in and the whole thing falls apart.
Go ahead, Kathleen.
The other thing that happens is if you continue cutting down the forest to plant the fields and crops to feed your people, you continue to raise atmospheric carbon dioxide levels. And eventually, the Earth will warm up enough to go through another period of drought like we had in 1100 AD. The drought lasted for 300 years. And you're not going to be able to grow the crops again. So you're reducing your food supply. And it's self-defeating, George. That's the problem.
I've got to ask you, too, this question because it is so topical. Have you been keeping track of the disappearing honeybees in this country?
We have been keeping track of that, yes.
I mean, this could be a calamity of biblical proportions, and nobody's really doing anything about it. We've got some universities now involved in trying to decide why they are dying, why they are disappearing. I've got my own views on that. But this could be a catastrophe.
Absolutely. It could be a catastrophe. And, once we figure out what's happening, maybe we can do something. But I don't know. We may be too late on that one, too.
Well, it could be in genetically modified crops. Anything could be causing this.
Right. It could be.
Self-pollinating, pesticides that are put in some of these things. You know, something's happening to them.
Right.
Yeah. And you keep in mind that agriculture itself destroys environment. Because if you go back 11,000 years ago when human beings were first inventing agriculture and figuring out how it worked, I mean, my God, North Africa was covered with oak trees. Same thing with the Middle East. You've seen the pictures of the tanks rolling across Iraq.
Yes.
Most of that desert that they're rolling across was covered with grain fields, with wild grains.
Some people believe even thousands of years ago that was where the Garden of Eden was.
Right, yeah. And, you know, in a very real sense, that's why the Sumerians built their first civilization there, because the fertile soils, the cereal grains that grew, the large number of trees that they had to use for building, for irrigation projects and things like that, and it's just desert.
What happened? What caused the desert?
Farming. What they did is they cut down the trees and put all of that into intensive cultivation, irrigated it, built canals, irrigated the fields, and when the soil was finally exhausted, the next thing that came in were weeds, so they put goats and sheep on the weeds, and eventually all they had left was barren dirt, what we call sea horizon soil.
Which is sterile soil.
Over thousands and thousands of years, I take it.
Right. Yeah, exactly. You know, and you think now in terms of, like, the Middle East, same thing. Israel, most of the Negev Desert, was covered by oak forest.
Oh, my.
Yeah.
Gone. Do you two factor in a possible asteroid strike or anything else that could wipe us out?
That is certainly possible. Obviously, that's happened in the past, you know, to a lot of different species. So it's certainly possible, and it will happen again, George. I mean, the odds are just so high that the Earth will sustain another asteroid impact or comet impact. So it's going to happen again. There's just no telling when.
What do you both see as the biggest problem to date then for us? And is it correctable?
Overpopulation. Is it correctable? Yes. How can you do it? That's the question.
And, you know, here's a thing we all have to think about, too, George. And I, there are a lot of people out there who say, well, let's just stop running cars and let's stop our coal-fired power plants and, you know, let's do something else. And the difficulty is until you have something else that works as well, you fall into what anthropologists call deprivation theory. And what that means is that when the price of building a house goes up so high because they're not cutting down any timber anymore, and you can't build your house to keep your family warm, you feel threatened, that your life is threatened. You know, the same thing, if you can't get to work every day because gasoline is being rationed, you know, to cut down the emissions in the atmosphere, and so your income drops so you can't feed your family. This is what causes enough stress in the society for warfare to break out. And I mean, keep in mind, I mean, with the Rodney King events in Los Angeles, it was a concept as abstract as justice being deprived that caused rioting. I mean, and everyone saw the results of that on television. It was horrifying. But deprivation theory is a very powerful motivating factor in human societies. And you cannot just, you know, cut off the food supply or cut off the fuel supply, because it will result in the collapse of our civilizations.
I take it you two do not subscribe to the man has created global warming theory.
Man is partially responsible, but there are a lot of natural features that go into this, George. I mean, you've probably had guests on who've talked about the Milankovitch cycles. There are orbital cycles that the Earth goes through on a natural basis that cause ice ages and global warming periods. Once every 100,000 years, the actual orbit of the Earth changes so that the Earth is further away from the sun, and it causes ice ages. Once every 41,000 years, the axis of the Earth shifts so that we're tilted away from the sun, and the Earth doesn't get as much solar radiation. It causes ice ages. Once every 22,000 years, the wobble of the Earth's axis shifts so that we're pointed further away from the sun. It causes ice ages. The problem is that human beings have exacerbated these natural cycles. And actually, with the 22,000-year cycle, I mean, we right now, as we were talking about before, we should be in an ice age. And for the most part, we stopped that through agriculture.
Okay, the fact that mankind may have stopped it through agriculture, what does that do to the planet? Is it a disruption? Well, because it is no longer the norm, because we don't have the ice age that the planet expected, what will that do?
Unknown territory.
We have no idea, because right now, George, we are in uncharted territory.
Right.
And this is one of the reasons why there has been so much confusion about global warming, because the scientists who are saying, hey, yeah, we're overdue for an ice age, they're right. And the other scientists who are saying, yeah, but, you know, we're headed for an extended period of warmth, they're right. And in essence, it's, you know, we've thrown the rule book away. And because we're in uncharted territory, it makes predictions really, really difficult.
Well, and it seems to be changing every other month, not just years now. I mean, we had the warmest March on record. Now we've got one of the coldest Aprils on record. I mean, it just doesn't make any sense anymore.
Yeah, one of the things that you see is wild fluctuations in temperature and precipitation, from, you know, extraordinarily hot and dry to extraordinarily wet and cold. And actually, that's one of the things that a paleoclimatologist will tell you is, in a way, good news, because glaciers start when you have mild summers, cool summers, and mild winters.
Right.
Because that's what, you know, mild winters, the air is warmer, it carries more moisture with it, snowfall in places like Labrador and Siberia increases, and then in a cool summer, it doesn't all melt. And if you have a period, and it can happen as quick as within 10 years, we've found, that you can go, you know, headlong into another ice age.
This you talked about the deforestation. Aren't we replacing the trees we cut down? Are they just not growing fast enough?
Oh, and nothing like we need to be doing. Keep in mind that when white guys got to North America in the early 1500s, 1600s, a squirrel
in
could
mass.
Run from... Pardon?
When lots of them got here in the 1500s and 1600s.
Right. Yeah, a squirrel could travel all the way from the Atlantic Ocean to the Mississippi and never set foot on ground. So it was entirely forested. When they started chopping down trees in Europe 8,000 years ago, it was a solid belt of trees from the Atlantic shore all the way into the central Russian steppes. So, I mean, we took out an awful lot of biomass.
Well, you know, and we know now vegetation creates more carbon dioxide. If we have less vegetation, you would think that our carbon dioxide would be dramatically less. Is that the case?
No, I got that backward.
Well, actually, it's both, George, and that's the problem, is rotting vegetation.
No, I do. I have that backwards. It takes in the carbon dioxide, spits out the oxygen.
Yeah, living plants do, but as vegetation decays, as it decomposes, it actually produces, it produces methane, which is technically swamp gas, which
right.
is another greenhouse gas, a heat-trapping gas.
Now, if human beings continue to face this on a year-by-year basis, are we going to continue to see these incredible stories in the news, these 10-foot snowstorms, these incredible typhoon-type rains? I mean, are we in for this forever?
Yeah, you are. And the reason for that is as the greenhouse gases increase, the air is warmer and consequently picks up more moisture. And in places like Southeast Asia, as well as the western United States, this feeds the monsoon patterns. And like in the western United States, we used to really depend on these things. In Southeast Asia and in India, the monsoon range, God, they're getting places where it's dropping 14, 15, 16 inches of rain out of a single storm.
I guess what is, scary, too, is the fact that you've got history with past civilizations. You've seen through documentation what happens on a smaller scale to certain regions on this planet.
Yes, we have. And it's pretty much the same thing over and over again, George, is, human beings go through these patterns. And in the near future, we're probably going to have to create a new category for hurricanes as the oceans warm, because as the oceans warm, it powers hurricanes. So we're probably going to have to create, level category 6 or 7 hurricanes.
Right, and go way beyond the 5s.
And right.
My gosh, what they would do. In your book, People of the Nightland, as you put into a fictional end, what's that theory?
People of the Nightland is set in the northeastern United States 13,000 years ago. And we picked this specifically because this is a period of increased global warming. This is when the ice sheets are melting back. And again, to put your listeners in perspective here, at the glacial maximum, when the glaciers were the biggest about 20,000 years ago, they extended down as far as Illinois and Indiana, almost to the Ohio River. Promptly, the Milankovitch cycle reaches its maximum. Everything is in the hot phase. The glaciers start melting like mad. And by 13,000 years ago, they have created a huge, gigantic freshwater melt lake that covers modern-day Manitoba, North Dakota, Minnesota, and Wisconsin. And we call this thing Lake Agassiz. It had more fresh water in it than all the freshwater lakes in the world today. 80,000 square miles of water. Where Winnipeg is today was under 650 feet of water, okay?
All right.
Okay, now, right at about 13,000 years ago, there's an ice dam that separates Lake Agassiz from the east. And the ice dam stretches across where modern-day Michigan is.
Okay.
It broke. And Lake Agassiz dropped by about 350 feet overnight. All that water, which had been kind of
blocked,
running over the dam and down the Mississippi, all that water went rushing through the eastern United States, scoured out what's now the St. Lawrence Seaway, and dumped itself into the Atlantic Ocean. By doing that, it shut off what's called the thermal highline current, which is the Gulf Stream that warms northern Europe. And it caused the reglaciation of Europe for almost 1,500 years.
That's amazing how that works. We'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM.